Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about North Korea. A week ago, North Korea conducted its second-ever nuclear test, that after agreeing last year to abandon its nuclear program. Also, in the last month or so, the country has conducted a number of tests of missiles, both long and short range. That raises concerns among its neighbors and also among other nations, including the United States and member states of the United Nations. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about reasoning behind these recent acts by the government of North Korea, perhaps what that means for its relations with the rest of the world. And our guest for the program is Douglas Paul. He is the Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. He previously served as Vice Chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase International and as unofficial U.S. representative to Taiwan as Director of the American Institute in Taiwan. That was between 2002 and 2006. He served on the National Security Council staffs of Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush between 86 and 93 as Director of Asian Affairs. He also served as Senior Director and Special Assistant to the President. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So if you're here locally and you'd like to call in, ask a question, make a comment, that's the number to use. We do also have a toll-free line, and so that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, we will pay for it. Just use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. The only thing that we ask of people who are calling in is that you just try to keep their questions and comments brief so we can keep moving along, but certainly anyone is welcome to call. Mr. Paul, hello.
Hi, good morning, David.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. There have been a number of events here going back to at least the early part of April that have raised concerns about North Korea and its intentions. There was the launch of a long-range rocket in early April on May 25th. There was the underground nuclear test. There had been some other missile tests, and I think the country has said it is intending to sometime soon here do another test of a long-range missile. And all of this, I think, has led people to ask this question, what's going on here? What is the intention of Korea? And I know there are a number of things we can talk about, and we can get into some depth and detail. I'm sure, though, that the answer to that question, what is going on in North Korea, is there's not just one answer. There are probably several answers.
I think that's right. And the United States government is itself in a bit of a quandary trying to figure out, one, what's going on, what's motivating the North, and two, how to respond to it. As we speak, there is a delegation led by the Deputy Secretary of State, Jim Steinberg, and some senior people from various departments of the Defense and National Security Council, for example, who are traveling to Beijing, Seoul, Tokyo, and Moscow to try to get the benefit of other countries' views on what's going on, what their ambassadors and others are reporting back from Pyongyang, North Korea, as to the intent of the regime there, and then what measures can be taken to respond to these latest developments in defiance of international sentiment and law.
Well, perhaps as one thing we might start out talking about is here now in the United States, we have a new administration. It's been in office a relatively short period of time. Does part of this perhaps have to do with North Korea's interest in probing the Obama administration just to find out exactly what to try to get some sense of what kind of pushback it's going to get or what kind of response it's going to get as a way of, I'm sure that the North Koreans, they're trying to figure out, well, who is Barack Obama and what is his administration all about and what's the potential for relations with this new administration?
Well, it would be characteristic for North Korea to give considerable consideration to a new regime coming into Washington, new people testing their willpower, testing their stamina against the North over the long term. One of the things that drives American politics, of course, is the four-year election cycle, and we tend to reshape our policies at the beginning and end of those cycles. And Korea has been trying to time its own activities. Going back to my time in office, back with Reagan and Father Bush, right up to the present. But I don't think that's the most important issue. I think what's driving us this time is a complicated set of factors, the most important of which appears to be the need for the North to arrange a succession for the current leader, Kim Jong-il, who is in his 68, roughly, and who has had a health crisis in the past year, and is looking just terrible in the films that they released to show how he's in charge and still running the government. Obviously, if you see him on film, you realize there's something wrong. We've seen activities behind the scenes, some of which have, you know, they occasionally lift the curtain and we get a small glimpse of what they're doing internally. And they've recently indicated that the 26-year-old son of Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un, is now being groomed to take over in a hurry for his ailing father. That's a preposterous notion in North Korea that someone 26 would be ready to take over a government that's largely run by gerontocrats, people up in their 70s and 80s. Normally, I mean, in the past, when Kim Jong-il was himself being groomed to succeed his father, who died in 1994, Kim Il-sung, there was 20 years plus of preparation and grooming and identification of the heir apparent. This time, there's been no public direct identification, just these indirect hints that the son is being groomed, and that there's a brother-in-law who's being given greater access to power in order to be a kind of regent for the young son, should father Kim Jong-il, who's currently ill, pass away anytime soon.
Well, as you say, the thinking is that apparently he had a stroke last summer, and as you say, for some period of time, I think he wasn't seen at all, which led to a lot of speculation about his condition. And then when he was seen, it looked like he certainly was not in good health, which I'm sure led to a lot of speculation and questions about, well, what would happen when he was no longer leading the country. And again, as you say, it seems that now the heir apparent is this young son. And of course, it's difficult to penetrate, maybe that's an understatement, difficult to penetrate the thinking of the leaders of this country. We simply don't really know. But having said that, is there any way to say, well, why this very young man, his very young son, who would certainly not be in a position to take over, and you would have to ask about what sort of acceptance he might have among the ruling elite and among the military, and it's very important that you have their support there. One wonders, well, why him?
Oh, that's right. And the facts are that there's three sons by one woman, and by two women, the first of which is not a legitimate son, so he's not an heir. The second is one who has been educated in Switzerland, but is apparently not ready to be put in that position of leadership. And the third son, this youngest one, is also educated in Switzerland extensively, speaks French and English, we're told, is seen to be a more promising candidate among them. Now, I think it's really important to say to you, David, and your listeners, that anybody who tells you who he knows what's going on in North Korea, who's not himself a North Korean leader, should be taken with a great big grain of salt. I'm going to try to represent what I've picked up from various sources and give you a sense of what I think is credible and what's not credible. Certainly, however, the regime has been leaning toward the military. Kim Jong-il, when he took over in 94, really has been ruling from the position of leadership of the military. He's given them a lot over the time, given the constrained resources available in North Korea. Now we see a succession taking shape, and the military seems to be even more so in charge, more being relied upon by the regime to carry out the necessary functions to protect the Kim family and the 600,000 or so people who constitute the privileged elite in North Korea.
Our guest, just to reintroduce in this part of Focus 580, is Doug Paul. He is the president, vice president for studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Has a lot of experience following politics in China and Taiwan, specifically and generally in Northeast and Southeast Asia. He served in the administrations of Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. He was on the National Security Council, staffs of both presidents between 86 and 93, as director of Asian Affairs, and then as senior director and special assistant to the president. And we're talking about North Korea. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. specifically on North Korea's intent to develop nuclear weapons. Do you think that they're thinking that these are things that they truly need for their defense, and that is they have real-world practical defense applications, or that it has much more to do with it, that their significance is more symbolic in the sense that having them shows that you are an important, significant player and that it puts you on a level with other nations that also have these weapons?
It appears that the North wants this largely for symbolic reasons. But, you know, what they want seems to have been changing. I first sat down with the North Koreans when we had our very first contact with them back in 1991, 92. And at that point, they started a process which culminated in the Clinton administration in 1994 with a deal where they would surrender their nuclear capabilities in exchange for two light water reactors, a flow of heavy fuel oil for their economy, for their power plants, and a number of other favors, including humanitarian assistance to feed their people during a tough period of agricultural failure in North Korea. At that time, they seemed to be willing to sell their nukes, in other words. Then the Bush administration came in 2000, and there were a number of missteps by the administration in the way it handled North Korea, and North Korea was caught also experimenting with an alternative to the plutonium process they had agreed to surrender in 1994. And so they seem to be circumventing the agreement. Now, how much they did to circumvent the agreement back then is unclear. We also know now, in hindsight, that they had been actively involved in sending a nuclear reactor to Syria. And it may have been the case that they were planning to help the Syrians go nuclear and also have themselves gain access to plutonium from Syria outside the agreement in which they had agreed not to have nuclear weapons. So there was a lot of bad faith evinced in that period, suggesting that they were not really willing to sell their nuclear program. And then in 2005, 2007, the latter part of the Bush administration, they made some progress toward what they called action-for-action agreements, whereby they would dismantle their fuel production facility, their nuclear reactor, and their plutonium refinement facility, and turn over their records on their nuclear behavior. No agreement has ever been reached, however, to turn over the actual weapons which they've made. That was supposed to be saved for Phase 3, which never came during the Bush administration, and which now lies before the Obama administration as, you know, one course of action to pursue. But in this period from 1994 to the present, it appears less and less likely that North Korea wants to sell us the nuclear weapons. Rather, they want to have the nuclear weapons. And they've been reinforced in this by the habits of, the developments elsewhere in the world. Mm-hmm. We've had the United States sign an agreement with India to normalize India's possession of nuclear weapons and still have a good, productive nuclear power relationship with the United States. This is in defiance of the longstanding provisions of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And so for North Korea, and by extension for Iran elsewhere in the world, the U.S. has created a precedent for people to have nuclear weapons and still have good relations with the rest of the world. So it's not an either-or situation in their view as it once was. Hmm. And so I think they're probing to see how much we will give and how much of the Indian example we will extend to North Korea and then eventually to Iran and other proliferators.
Do we know how much nuclear material or how many weapons North Korea has at present?
The number of weapons we don't know. Based on the estimates of production that have been handled by a number of really fine scientists, there's material to make 6 to 8 weapons. They've now fired sort of 1.5 weapons off, reducing their available stockpile. So they're going to be left, unless they reopen the reactor, as they say they're going to do, and reopen the fuel supply and the plutonium reprocessing facilities and their bomb-making factory, until they reopen it, they're going to have 6 to 8 weapons, which is a very minimal force. And this is, bear in mind, a country which really is no longer an industrial power. For them to try to build hundreds of long-range missiles or hundreds of weapons is beyond their capacity. So their threat is primarily one of deterrence, I guess, in their words, It's also a threat to use it against their southern neighbors in South Korea or against Japan. And it's that concern that has the United States and other nations most on alert, because if we allow the presence of nuclear weapons to establish itself on North Korea, South Korea and Japan will be sorely tempted by their political processes internally to use their nuclear reactors as a base for their own nuclear weapons programs and self-defense.
That was one of the things that I wanted to talk about here, whether you felt that the concern among the neighbors was enough so that some of these other neighboring countries that don't have nuclear programs but that could, technologically speaking, could do it if they made that choice to do it, would in fact be prompted to do that. And Japan is one of the places that I'm particularly interested in, and that certainly would be a very significant step for the Japanese to take, whether that might be a real possibility.
I think it's a real possibility. I think it's an unlikely step for either power, and it has a lot to do with how the U.S. responds to this artificial crisis being created by North Korea. If the U.S., and I don't think this is going to happen, but if the U.S. were to do nothing, people in Japan and South Korea would call for their own governments to take appropriate steps. However, we have existing alliance arrangements with these two countries, and if over the weekend you may have noticed Secretary of Defense Robert Gates made a speech in Singapore in which he said the United States would not stand idly by as North Korea carries out this activity. And by that, I don't know precisely what he meant, because I haven't talked to him about it, but my guess is that he was just saying, we will not stand idly by and leave our allies unprotected, and steps will be taken to raise levels of preparedness. Japan, for example, has a number of point defense anti-missile systems. They could use more. South Korea has some. They could use more. Different things can be done to raise levels of alert or to remix the kinds of defensive systems we have in those two countries to make sure that they feel that we have adequately addressed the kind of threat that's being made by North Korea.
Mm. Well, that it seems to me that in some of the stories that I have read about the comments of Secretary Gates was he seemed to be interested in clarifying that to the extent that he didn't want anybody to get the idea that the United States was talking about any kind of direct military intervention here, and that in fact I thought certainly that some of the stories that I read said what he was talking about was not military pressure, but he was talking about diplomatic pressure.
Well, I think he was talking about diplomatic pressure additionally to various steps that will be taken in consultation between the relevant defense establishments to make sure they've done what they need to do to deal with the nuclear or missile threat increments that have been developed by North Korea. Mm-hmm. It may amount to nothing more than discussions. Certainly diplomatically, we've got this team now going from country to country through the region, trying to work out a common policy to maximize the pressure we do bring to bear on North Korea, to make it clear that what they're doing is not acceptable and that it does not become a demonstration of how to defy the international community that will be learned by Tehran and Iran or other places, that this will have a limited or contained effect on the global situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of real security concerns here now, North Korea, we know that they have nuclear material and we believe that they have some number of weapons and they have been testing missiles both short and long range. So this raises the question, well, if they have these nuclear weapons, they have these missiles, what could they possibly do with them and who is threatened? And it seems that the threat to the United States, the continental United States, is small, if there at all. But you could understand how it is that the Japanese and the South Koreans would be concerned. But then it does invite the question, well, what really would be the likelihood that even if they had the capability of dropping a bomb on Tokyo or on Seoul, whether they would do it or not?
Well, I think that they're in their hearts, they're in their policy councils, they're well aware that if they launch some kind of military action against Seoul or Tokyo, there'll be a devastating response from both those countries and the United States as part of our alliance response. And that would spell the end of the North Korean regime. That's why people like Secretary Gates and others are not talking about a military response to the provocations from North Korea, because it would set us on a devastating course. And And that's really not what the North is threatening. What they're playing is a game of diplomacy, trying to up their ante, playing their domestic politics, we believe, but we don't know very well how that's playing out internally. And what we have the greatest concern about is that they will see that the way to market themselves internationally is by selling missiles or nuclear materials either to states or to non-states like terrorist groups. And therefore, a lot of the effort of the administration right now, and that's true of the governments in Tokyo and Seoul as well, is to eliminate the possibility of proliferation, the shipment of various kinds of missiles, other weapons, and nuclear material out of North Korea to rogue states or terrorist groups. That's where the real threat comes from, because those groups would not be deterred in the same way that North Korea is now deterred by our alliance structure in Northeast Asia.
We have a caller. We invite others, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We are just about at our midpoint. Let me just very quickly again introduce our guest, Douglas Paul. He's Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He is interested and has followed politics in China and Taiwan for a long time, and also generally North and Southeast Asia. He served in the Reagan and first Bush administrations. He was on the National Security Council staffs of both Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush between 86 and 93, and also director of Asian Affairs, and then as a senior director and special assistant to the president. Questions welcome. Again, 333-WILL-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's caller, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Very important subject, of course. I recommend a variety of viewpoints on this, too. Bruce Cummings at the University of Chicago has a relatively recent book out called North Korea, Another Country, and Chalmers Johnson is a sort of a dissident viewer of the Pacific Rim framework. I'm going to use that word again shortly and mention the agreed framework. Cummings, I think, fell out of the NPR Rolodex because I think he was apparently too critical of when he was reviewing the to and froing, the diplomatic history and the I would say malfeasance perhaps on both sides, but certainly there's we hear about the Koreans, North Koreans reneging on agreements, but we don't often hear that the U.S. didn't fulfill its side of the agreements either. This plutonium processing started happening after the agreed framework was basically deep sixed by the current administration, the present temporary administration. This non-fulfillment of pledges goes on. The Japanese have supplied less than half of the fuel oil that was agreed at the six-party talks, and it seems to me that if the Obama administration wanted to start out on a different foot with Korea, North Korea, and the whole rim area, is they shouldn't have let the Defense Department, they should have scaled back or done some kind of coordination. The annual spring military exercises went ahead, and that is seen by the North Koreans as a provocation. They don't see themselves as provoking without cause. I have no brief for the draconian system there, but I do know that Cummings brings up the fact that, 30% of the population was wiped out in 1950, and that kind of decimation of a population has to have an effect through the years. It's been desolate for quite a few years for a number of reasons. I know this is a long screed, but I do have to point out we know that the Syrians and the Koreans got together on a project. Well, we believe that it was a nuclear project, but the idea that was offered, I think, by the speaker that the Koreans were going to get around surveillance by getting nuclear material out of Syria when it's heavily surveilled is ludicrous. It'd be much easier for them to have a mountain redoubt and another processing plant there. One can attack it as proliferation, but certainly not as a way of getting around their obligations, et cetera, et cetera. So I'd like for you to check off at least one or two of those points, if you would.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Paul.
Okay, thank you. Well, there are the a couple. I mean, you can break down the schools of analysis of policy toward North Korea generally into two groups. One is the appeasers, characterized by the alternative group, and one called the hardliners, by the people who would be characterized by the hardliners as appeasers. And we tend to get into divide into these two camps. Neither camp has ever really satisfactorily dealt with all the facts, from my point of view. It really requires people to pick apart the evidence very carefully. In the case mentioned by the caller just a moment ago about Syria and the use of nuclear material from Syria by North Korea, the interesting thing about the Syrian program was there was never any other element of the program identified in Syria, even though they are heavily surveilled. They've found no reprocessing facility, no full fuel fabrication facility. It was just a reactor that would produce nuclear waste, which then could be reprocessed somewhere, and presumably North Korea would have an interest in doing that. That's the best guess that can be made about it, and it would help to explain why they took such a big risk in providing that technology to Syria. But it's not a satisfactory explanation, and I can understand the caller would not be satisfied with my response because we don't know all the facts in this case. It is a reasoned line of conjecture at this point, waiting for history to unfold the documents or someone to come out and tell us more precisely what was going on. Pledges between the two sides having been not kept, yeah, there's all kinds of bad faith declared by both sides. From the point of view of the U.S., the U.S. provided 1 million tons of heavy fuel oil year after year for North Korea to get to the point where we were in August last year when we expected North Korea to permit some inspections of their equipment and also to look more closely into the proliferation and alternative nuclear fuel production capabilities, and the whole process broke down. Now North Korea has, some months later, declared all agreements since 1953 to be null and void, and gone back on all of them. And a lot of people in the American administration would say, well, hey, we'd like our fuel back. If you're not going to keep the agreements, we've paid you for all of this. How about returning some of that? So you get people on both sides claiming bad faith and failure to keep your pledges. But the fact is that international agreements are very tricky business. Verification and acknowledgement that the other party has kept all of its promises is always difficult, especially in the political environment.
Well, if I got a rejoinder,
yeah.
I think the Syrian whatever was going on there was likely some kind of probe too of testing what was possible and highlighting again the fact that they're nominally part of the NPT, but their opponent Israel is never signed, et cetera. So I don't accept the basic premise that that we know what was really going on there. You didn't mention the military exercises. Now I've heard these dismissed that they're just an annual exercise and they don't really mean anything. Well, that's easy for people on this side to say, but I think that if we're going to let the Pentagon run the foreign policy, we should just defund further the State Department and be done with it. But if we're going to make a break from the past, it seems one would have to start with something like that. And I'll hang up and see if there are any other callers probing this subject. And I do recommend again Bruce Cummings, if anybody wants to hear a different point of view on it.
All right. We're at our a little bit past midpoint here again. Questions are welcome. We're talking about North Korea, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our guest is Douglas Paul. He's Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about here now was the where things stand with the six-party talks. This is a series of talks that have been going on off and on for something like 6 years, and the object was to talk about the North Korean nuclear weapons program, and these are talks that involve the United States, Russia, Japan, China, and North and South Korea. Given now where we are, what's been happening, and also this uncertainty about the leadership here now in the next, maybe even in the next couple of years in North Korea, what does that say about the status of the six-party talks? Are they effectively over, or would we say that perhaps they would be in suspension for some period of time?
Well, the North Koreans say they're over, that they've come to an end. The United States and the other parties, especially China, which has been the hosting party for the six-party talks, say that they would like to see the North return to the talks and accept that they will continue. So we're at an impasse between the various views. The Obama administration and its partners have said to the North Koreans that despite what you've said and done in the last few months, if you walk back from those threats and pledges and disruptions of international agreements, we can sit down with you and continue talking in the six-party talk framework. Six-party talks is valuable because it brings all the material parties to a solution on the North Korean peninsula to one table. The Japanese, who would provide a lot of money as part of normalizing relations with North Korea, the Russians, who have had a long trade and other relationship with North Korea, the Chinese, who are the principal trading and alliance partner of North Korea, South Korea, which would be presumably providing a lot of resources and human talent to help North Korea deal with its economic future. These are all the necessary parties. At the same time, sitting down and negotiating among six parties is a really tough process. And the U.S., in the latter part of the Bush administration, agreed that it would also have a bilateral component where the North's complaint that the U.S. doesn't talk to it directly or address their security concerns directly would actually have direct talks with its envoy. And the Bush and the Obama administration coming in chose to stick with the six-party talks format and even upgraded them in a sense by appointing a special envoy, Steve Bosworth, who's the dean of the Tufts School, Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University. And he's been traveling the region and has been trying to go to North Korea and sit down and talk to them, but has been told by the North Koreans not to come. And meanwhile, his efforts to stir up the diplomacy have been repeatedly rejected by North Korea. So the answer to your question is we're at an impasse as to whether the six-party talks exist or don't exist, whether they will go forward or not. We have to get through this testing period of the North giving a tough, making a tough series of gestures to the outside world and the world trying to decide how to respond in a way that's adequately tough to tell the North Koreans this is a fruitless approach and at the same time not so tough as to raise tensions and add greater danger to Northeast Asia or the global situation.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else here in Mattoon, line number two. Pardon me, now line, I think line number one. Hello?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Hey, I would just like to make a quick comment. I want to apologize to the guest for the last caller. He's our local Champaign County communist, and he calls in, and it's always everybody else's fault, and he's always complaining. Sorry about him. He's our local communist. Thank you.
Well, I guess all I would say is that all comments are welcome, and he and anybody is welcome to call in and make their contributions. And I would certainly say that the first caller has been a caller over long, many years and has contributed a lot of interesting thoughts and good ideas, and he's somebody who spends a lot of energy following a current event. So I don't think he needs to feel bad. Or anybody needs to apologize for him. Let me just also invite other people to call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We're just talking a moment ago about the six-party talks, and one of the six parties here is China. And I think for a long time now, the feeling has been that if there is any government that is in a position to perhaps do some meaningful negotiation and possibly put a little bit of pressure on the North Koreans, it's China. And that apparently also in China, in Beijing, they're not happy with what Korea has been doing lately. They apparently were not particularly happy about the second nuclear test. They're not very happy about these weapons tests, these missile launches. So that might suggest, well, maybe now that the Chinese might be slightly more inclined to maybe put a little bit more pressure or at least be more assertive they're talking with the North Koreans. Do you think that that's possible?
It's possible, and it's certainly a subject of active debate in China. 3 years ago, if you were talking to Chinese about North Korea, nobody would break the party line. They would all in lockstep say, we have to support our brothers in North Korea. We hope they will sit down and talk with you, Americans, Japanese, etc., and reach a peaceful settlement to keep the regime stable. With this first nuclear test in October 2006, we really saw a division emerge among Chinese experts on North Korea. Some saying, you know, our policy of China, which has been to balance concerns for the stability and viability of the regime in the North with a concomitant desire to make sure it does not have nuclear weapons, and that the nuclear weapons do not become common to North Korea, South Korea, and Japan. That would not be in China's interest. So China's been caught between the rock and the hard place, the rock being keeping the North and its very peculiar regime alive so that China has a buffer state on its border, does not have a U.S. alliance member right up on its border in the Northeast. And at the same time, China does not face a rising nuclear capacity in Northeast Asia, which it would have to deal with. Now the North Koreans have sort of taken China to the end of walking a path between the rock and the hard place without bumping into one or the other. They've now, and I was just reading this morning, one of China's most distinguished foreign policy experts published a piece saying that the policy to save the regime from itself in North Korea has come to an end. It's no longer possible. Now, the regime has not announced that, but it suggests the kind of debate that's going on inside China. You know, how much can they squeeze, how much should they squeeze North Korea at our behest and for their own reasons, and to what extent should they be willing to risk setting in motion the collapse of a North Korean regime with very unpredictable consequences for the Korean Peninsula.
Mm. Going back to the what's, as much as we can say this, what's the intention, what's in the mind of leadership in North Korea, the question is, what kind of relations do they want with the rest of the world? And do they, in fact, do you think, would they, obviously, we know for a variety of reasons, they want to pursue this nuclear program, and so that's not something that they're likely to give up. But they're also, I think, questions have been raised about, well, what kind of relationship do they want to have with the rest of the world and with the United States? Do you think that, in fact, they do want normal relations with the rest of the world, but I suppose the issue is, well, they want them on their terms, and part of their terms would be to be an acknowledged nuclear power.
Well, normally we would be able to find patterns of behavior that suggest that they really do have a stake in good relations with the rest of the world, even though they may use very tough tactics to get there. But more recently, we've seen less of that. A good example are the two young journalists who are about to go on trial in North Korea for illegally entering the country. These two people are American citizens of Korean origin, and they were working for a TV network, which has Al Gore, former vice president, as an important financial and leader, backer and leader of the network. And my understanding was that Vice President Gore was prepared to fly to North Korea to intercede on behalf of these reporters to bring a big name and a big political connection to offer the North Koreans something in return for hoping that they will relent on the trial of these two women. When Gore's people signaled he was ready to go, he was told, don't come. When Special Envoy Bosworth indicated he wanted to go to North Korea, he was told, don't come. So they don't seem to be looking for that kind of outside connection right now. They're not playing the game as they have played it for the past couple of decades. Something new is going on, and this tends to reinforce the analysts who believe that the preoccupation with setting up a succession for the current leader to his son is driving out all other considerations, that having a nuclear capability by the year 2012 so that the North Korean successor leadership will be invulnerable to outside pressure seems to be the kind of mental game that's going on. And we see this in one of the few outlets of North Korea in the outside world. There's a newspaper published in Japan called Chosun Shimbun, which tries very hard to faithfully represent what North Korea is thinking. And they've repeatedly described how there's a 2012 deadline to strengthen the military to the point where the North will consider itself basically invulnerable to outside pressure through the ability to lash out with nuclear weapons mounted on long-range missiles.
Hmm. Well, then you can imagine if they get to a point like that, that you could actually make the argument that maybe one of two things could happen if they feel that they're invulnerable to outside pressure. That might make them even more intransigent and unlikely to negotiate, but also it might be that if they feel that they're really invulnerable to outside pressure, that might make them feel more comfortable actually about negotiating, because then they would feel that they were negotiating from a position of strength. So I suppose you could see that actually going either way.
It could go either way. And you have the contemporary example of the China of the last 30 years. When China set off its first nuclear weapon in 1964 and was entering in the Cultural Revolution, it appeared to be nothing but threat and bad news for the rest of the world. But within a decade, that had been transformed into a quasi-alliance relationship with the U.S., and then three decades of domestic reform have led to a very different kind of China. Not without problems, but a very different kind of China. What we haven't seen thus far in North Korea is more than a very tentative putting of one or two toes in the water toward reform of the economy. The North has not found a way to keep the state the way they want to keep it, the people in power they want to keep in power, and devolve economic authority to the people of Korea, of North Korea. They're still heavily agricultural. Their industries are not working well. They don't produce exportable products, and they're difficult to invest in. Now, China has been investing in North Korea more than anybody else, and has been trying a kind of subtle policy of bringing North Korea to a point where it will do the kinds of reforms China has done. Meanwhile, China is profiting from being able to exploit the commodities and other things that they're exporting out of North Korea to the Chinese economy. So they've been trying to sort of do what they consider to be a good policy job, while at the same time making some money at it. The North Koreans are not on that path toward domestic economic reform to the same degree that China has been for three decades. And so any suggestion that you could turn the current crisis into an opportunity in the future through North Korea gaining strength and self-confidence is at this point highly conjectural.
Mm-hmm. We have just about 6-7 minutes left. We have another caller coming up here, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Another caller here where we are in Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
You were just talking about the domestic economy. Export doesn't indicate support for the domestic population. Are they a source of discontent that needs to be dealt with? And then the lower level military in other countries, the colonels often are the basis of regime change and perhaps coup d'etats. Is North Korea subject to that? Thank you. I'll listen off the air.
All right.
Oh, that's a good question from your caller. The issue of North Korean discontent is a serious one. As the regime has had its difficulties, more and more, not great numbers, but compared to historically, a few people have been able to get in and see the scene and then come back out and report on it. And we do know that the people are in very bad shape economically, physically. The average height and the weight of the population has been declining in recent years. Discontent has been able to express itself largely through the refugee population, which goes out through the northern border or by boat to China, and then hooks up with South Korean refugee groups and finds their way down through Southeast Asia or back to South Korea, or alternatively are caught by the Chinese and occasionally sent back to North Korea, where they face a very difficult time. That's one level of discontent. The one thing people say who observe this discontent level at a microscopic level is that equally strong in North Korea is the repression apparatus, that the police, the all-seeing, all-hearing police, are very quick to find people who are political dissidents and punish them or execute them. And so the North does not face an organized opposition from its own people. Therefore, the second part of the caller's question is very insightful. In regimes like this, it's usually the security apparatus that upends the regime when they decide the game is over. If you look back to 1989, when the East European regimes were collapsing as the Soviets lost the will to enforce the empire any further, Ceausescu, who ran one of these similar highly repressive regimes in Romania, was himself captured and then killed by his own security apparatus, and the security apparatus then set itself up as the so-called reformist succession to the Ceausescu regime. That seems to be a more likely course of action should Kim Jong-il's grip or his son's grip fail to hold the regime together, that it would be either senior generals or some group of generals who would take power in their own hands and try to enforce their authority in the country. How much good or bad that would do for international relations remains to be seen. This is a subject that really needs to be discussed between the United States and China officially and probably in secret. There has been an effort by the U.S. for some time to persuade the Chinese authorities to come to a nice quiet setting somewhere and say, okay, if the regime in North Korea starts to unravel, whether from the bottom up or from the top, and we start to see big changes taking place, we're going to want to know what happens to the nuclear weapons. We want to know who's going to have the keys. We're going to want to be able to protect our interests there. China certainly will not want a sea of refugees coming across the border into China, and China may be disposed to send troops to stop that. The U.S. and South Korea may have their own reasons to send troops or special forces to secure the nuclear weapons if they can be found. Before all this happens, before it all unfolds, and we run the risk of getting into conflict with each other or misunderstanding the other's intentions as we react to an unfolding crisis, let's sit down and talk about these contingencies in advance. Now, for years, China has refused to do so, to talk about these contingencies. Interestingly, as a sign that something new is in the air, like the debate among Chinese experts I discussed earlier, for the first time, Chinese experts are saying, let's sit down with American experts and talk about contingencies. This still hasn't happened at the high level, at official level, it needs to happen at. But I think that we're on the path to high-level contingency planning to help prepare for the day that we have to deal with an unraveling North Korean regime.
Yeah. We're coming down the point. We have a couple of minutes. It seems to be the case that the United Nations, the United States, the Chinese, the Russians, all of us together, it's not going to be possible for us to force North Korea to abandon its nuclear program. And it also seems not very likely that we could even come up with some range of enticements to persuade them to do that, which then leads to the question, can we live with a nuclear North Korea in the sense that it may be indeed something that we have to live with, if we could, particularly if we could deal with the proliferation concerns, would we be able to say, well, we're maybe not happy about it, but we could accept North Korea being a nuclear power?
My guess is that the international community, expressed through diplomatic means, would be able, in fact, to live with the weapons and take the necessary precautions against them, but would never be in a position to say publicly that we accept them. We'd have to put it into that twilight zone between acknowledgement of the reality by our behavior, but refusal to acknowledge that reality through our words. And the reason for that is the demonstration effect in Iran and Syria and elsewhere, where we have would-be proliferators who would look for debating points and excuses to take the pressure off themselves as they seek to build nuclear weapons capabilities.
Hmm. So it sounds like it would be here actually for people who watch North Korea maybe unsettling, but an interesting time here over the next few years as we watch to the extent that we can see what happens in this transition between Kim Jong-il and whoever, whether it's his son, Kim Jong-un, or somebody else. It's going to, for that to be consolidated, it could take some time. And if not, well, then who knows what's going to happen. It sounds like it could be a period of uncertainty that might continue for some years.
Now, it's in the North Koreans' interest to try to stir up anxiety and excitement and rapid responses, and it's more likely to be in the West's interest to react calmly, send strong messages, slowly crank up the pressure through sanctions regimes, getting China to take a more real and Russia to take more realistic positions on sanctions, but not to panic, not to chase after North Korea at this point. There are people who have been predicting for more than a decade the regime is about to fall, and they've been proven wrong so far. Someday they may be right, but governments can't take bets on that kind of proposition. Governments have to pursue middle courses to shape events, and I think the U.S. is going to calmly continue to offer talks to the North Koreans to say that everything's on the table, but not to accede to the North Korean unilateral destruction of the peace arrangements that have been made on the peninsula since 1950, nor to provide North Korea with relief from international sanctions in order to appease them. I think that will be not in the cards in the near future.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Douglas Paul, is Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. He served on the National Security Council staffs of both Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush between 86 and 93 as Director of Asian Affairs and then as Senior Director and Special Assistant to the President. Mr. Paul, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.